You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Times reported this week that domestic automakers ended a miserable year with some less bad sales figures. Ford reported a 33% rise in U.S. sales this December from a year ago, but Chrysler sales were down 36%, and General Motors remains 60% owned by the federal government. Ford, Chrysler, and GM report that their sales should steadily improve in the coming year, and here to discuss their prospects and how the big three got into this mess is Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Ingrassia, whose latest book is called Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hi.
Well, thank you, Leonard. Happy to be here.
You were the former Detroit bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal covering the auto industry for 25 years. Got your Pulitzer Prize in 1993 with Joseph B. White for reporting on the management crises at GM then.
Yes.
Could you have imagined? Could you have imagined that things would get so bad that you... That they'd be this in such bad shape now?
No, honestly. I mean, you know, the idea of General Motors going bankrupt is almost like, you know, the U.S. government going out of business, or as I say in the book, it's almost like the thought of an African-American being elected president of the United States, or it's almost like Wall Street going broke in a single weekend. So it was a remarkable year last year, and quite sad what happened to Detroit. It was unnecessary. There was a lot of self-inflicted wounds.
You say in the book that if GM and Chrysler had filed for bankruptcy in another time, stock markets around the world would have collapsed in panic. But when GM filed on June 1st, 2009, the Dow actually rose 221 points.
You know, it was amazing, actually. And in fact, to be more specific, Leonard, if you go back a couple years where GM actually lowered its financial guidance for its earnings, the stock markets around the world sold off en masse. And the contrast between that and the reaction, the relieved reaction when they filed for bankruptcy, under the auspices, of course, of the federal government, was remarkable.
But the bankruptcy filing itself, as you note, begins with rhetorical flourishes. Quote, GM has been a major component of the U.S. manufacturing and industrial base, as well as the market leader in the automotive industry. They're saying this as they're going under. The company noted that it made 450 million earthbound vehicles during its century of existence. It really is an impressive record.
Well, it's more than just the numbers, to be honest with you. I mean, General Motors really invented modern marketing. If you go back into the early years of the auto industry, in the teens and early years of the prior century, Henry Ford dominated the industry with a philosophy of one size fits all, and that was, of course, the Model T Ford. In the mid-1920s, Alfred Sloan of GM came along with a new philosophy that basically we're going to create a hierarchy of brands that will display your status in life and let you express yourself, essentially. So you'd start life in a Chevrolet, hopefully, and then move up through a Pontiac, an Oldsmobile, a Buick, and then maybe, if you're one of the fortunate few, to a Cadillac. So this whole idea of modern marketing was created by GM. The company also became...
And the others followed suit.
And the others followed suit. They had to, because that was the way the world was going. In 1955, General Motors became the first corporation on Earth to earn more than $1 billion in a single year.
And, of course, we had Charles Wilson saying what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Right. Those were in his confirmation hearings to become Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense. And, you know, that saying has sort of lived on forever.
But it hasn't turned out that way. In 2009, foreign and domestic automakers combined sold only about 10.4 million vehicles. That's down 21% from 2008. So foreign automakers aren't doing all that well either?
Well, no one's doing well in this economy, to be honest, but some are doing worse than others. I mean, look, Toyota had its first loss in 60 years last year, but it didn't go bankrupt. Honda actually made a small profit last year. They were the company that sort of least went overboard into the big truck and SUV thing.
And it's interesting that Toyota, with the Prius, which seems to be the car of the future, did have a loss.
Well, it is. See, what Toyota did was they also, at the same time they were doing the Prius at the other end of the spectrum, they opened a brand new factory in Texas to make a big full-size pickup truck, you know, for the guys that have Mars lights and gun racks on their truck and that sort of thing. And that plant's really is not paid off financially. The truck has not been popular, and the plant is half empty.
Well, they weren't they watching what was going on in Detroit? Isn't that what got Detroit in all that trouble?
Well, it is. But on the other hand, that was one of the few places of the market where Toyota was not really represented, the full-size pickup truck. That was sort of the last American bastion, if you will, Ford versus Chevy versus Dodge, and Toyota wanted it.
Would the numbers last year have been even bleaker without the Cash for Clunkers program?
Oh, sure. They would have been. I don't think the Cash for Clunkers was a very good idea from a policy standpoint, but sure, it did boost sales.
Well, it was instituted initially in Germany, and Americans asked, why aren't we doing this? It had helped the German economy, hadn't it?
Well, I think it probably helped. I'm sure it helped the economy here, too. It helped auto dealers. On the other hand, you know, Leonard, there's a thing in life where an idea starts out as a small germ and it goes too far. A friend of mine down in Florida got a new golf cart in Cash for Clunkers. He doesn't know whether to be proud of it or ashamed of it.
Well, that's the sort of thing that those are the embarrassing things we see no matter what the government policy
exactly.
is. Possibly one of the worst public relations nightmares is when the heads of the big three flew to Washington on three separate private jets last year to ask for money from the government. Are they so out of touch?
Well, sure. I mean, when you get to that level of any institution or corporation, basically, it's easy to get out of touch. It's easy for everyone to tell you your time is so much more important than everybody else's. And, gee, if I fly down commercially, I might miss that 2:30 meeting or something like that. It was just part of the package. It's what we do.
But you also say that part of the problem in their culture is a kind of a segregation. And we're not talking about racial segregation. There actually are different bathrooms for different people in different levels.
Well, there used to be. There used to be, and that's part of the cultural legacy of these companies. Now, almost all that, if not all of it, has gone away. But you know, the incident I refer to in the book is in the about 1987, where General Motors asked me to look at the labor relations and management cooperation at some of its factories, and at one factory near Buffalo, New York. I toured the factory, got a great dog and pony show, if you will. Before I got the plane back to Detroit, I said, hey, I have to go to the men's room. They said, sure, it's right around the corner. And I was shocked to see the salary men's restroom and the hourly men's restroom right next to each other. I mean, all the dog and pony show I had gotten about labor management cooperation fell apart in that moment.
And what was their reasoning? Men going to be dirtier than the executives? This is a blue-collar, white-collar segregation.
Yeah, exactly. It's segregation not by race, but by rank, if you will. And the reasoning was partly, you know, hey, I'm better than you are. This is a management privilege. And the other reason, frankly, in some factories, managers were afraid to get too close to hourly workers. They'd afraid they'd be assaulted.
Had any of the senior auto executives of the big three come up through the ranks, started off in the other bathroom?
No, not really.
My guest is Paul Ingracia. His latest book is called Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. The book is published by Random House. In an article in the Wall Street Journal, you said that you were initially skeptical about President Obama's auto task force, but that you've been won over. What's won you over?
Well, I'll make a confession here. I'm a Republican. I'm a free market guy, if you will. And I also I was skeptical of the idea of rescuing these companies to begin with. And then when they brought in a bunch of, frankly, industry outsiders who didn't know the business, you know, Wall Street private equity veterans, I thought, gee, or how are they going to understand what needs to be done? But in fact, what happened, and it's why you should keep an open mind as a journalist, to be honest with you. In fact, what happened is because they were outsiders, they were able to see some of the ridiculous practices that were taken for granted in Detroit, such as the jobs bank, which paid auto workers indefinitely for being laid off, and inverse layoffs where senior workers would choose to be laid off so they could be in the jobs bank and push junior workers back onto the assembly line. Eight different brands at General Motors, which made no sense with about 20-25% of the market. So they were able to cut through a lot of the stuff that these companies had come to take for granted.
Well, you've said repeatedly that the corporate culture is supposed to breed men and women who can make the tough decisions, but it took the President of the United States to step in and make those decisions for the automakers. Because this culture was just so was so hardened in their minds, or was it impossible for them to do it under the system that they were working in?
Of course it was not impossible. As a matter of fact, Ford Motor Company's success in avoiding bankruptcy and making those very same tough decisions is proof that it wasn't impossible. I mean, one of the most remarkable things over the last few years.
Well, what did Ford do? Did they eliminate any of their lines?
Yes, they did. Every time General Motors zigged in the last few years, Ford zagged. And let me be specific about that. GM believed that its CEO that had presided over the company's decline, Rick Wagoner, who became CEO in 2000, the board believed he was the only guy that could fix GM and kept him around. In Ford's case, they brought in a new CEO, Alan Mulally, an industry outsider, in 2006. So that's one zigzag. The next zigzag is while GM was keeping all of its eight brands, Mr. Mulally very quickly said, we can't afford to own Jaguar. We can't afford to own Land Rover, and we can't afford to own Volvo. We're going to sell them.
Even though those have been revered brands.
Revered, but not financially successful brands. And, you know, GM, meanwhile, kept Saturn and Saab, and they were losing money for 20 years straight. And the third big zigzag thing is that General Motors sold control of its financing arm, GMAC, to a private equity group in New York, Cerberus, the same company that owned Chrysler, bought Chrysler from the Germans, whereas Ford kept control of Ford Motor Credit. Credit is the lifeline of the auto industry. Companies have to be able to lend to dealers and to customers.
I remember when this thing started, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which, I can't remember who wrote it, but he said, why are we yelling at Rick Wagoner? He's doing all the right things, and he has all these new cars on the line that are going to be going to save us an awful lot of money at the gas tank. You're saying that was misguided?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, when Rick Wagoner took over as CEO in 2000, GM stock was at an all-time high. Company's market share was right around 30%. 8 years later, the company was making tens of billions of dollars of losses despite record car sales in the mid-years of the last decade. Market share had dropped to the low 20s, so the record was bad across the board.
Our sense was that people in other countries knew how to do these things better, but Chrysler was bought by, or pretty much controlled by Daimler.
It absolutely was.
And it went into a serious deterioration. Why did that happen?
Well, you know, the Daimler-Chrysler merger back in 1997 was based on this sort of corporate ideal, if you will, of synergies. But the truth is there weren't any synergies. The Mercedes guys were not going to use Dodge door handles on their cars.
But what about the other way around? Couldn't you put, not necessarily a Dodge, but couldn't you have put a better Chrysler car onto the basic Mercedes bottom?
Well, of course you could have, but what happened is that, in fact, the Mercedes engineers were very protective. They thought they did not want to dilute their brand identity by making Chryslers into mini Mercedes, if you will. And the culture clash was just enormous. I mean, the first big fight the two companies had was over the size of their business cards. I mean, give me a break.
We'll take a little break, and we'll come back and find out just what the role of the unions played in all of this, and what happened with Saturn, a car that was introduced with great fanfare. It was going to be the American answer to the Japanese cars, the Honda especially, and now is one of the great disasters. Paul Ingracia is the author of Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. It's published by Random House. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Ingracia, the former president of Dow Jones Newswires and former Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1993 with Joseph B. White for reporting on management crises at General Motors. And he has been covering the auto industry for over 25 years, which has led to his latest book called Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. It's published by Random House. Well, should we blame the UAW for some of these problems? After all, unions do negotiate the contracts that will best help the people they represent.
Well, sure, we should blame the UAW, but not entirely and not even primarily. I mean, after all, managers were the ones that signed those contracts, too. But the union basically signed richer and richer contracts beginning in the 1970s that ended up killing the goose that laid the golden egg. Let me give you a couple of examples. 1970, they won 30 years and out retirement, and 3 years later, the minimum age for that was eliminated entirely. So you could begin work in a car factory at age 18, retire at age 48, and then if you live till age 78 or 9, you would collect pension and benefits for longer than you worked.
In talking about the health crisis in America, many people have pointed out that part of the problem goes back to those early contracts with the automakers because they wanted to do something to avoid socialized medicine in America. So they came up with health plans that became the norm in America.
Well, that's partly true and partly not true. Yes, they became the norm in America, but don't forget what the auto workers did and the car companies did was go further than really anyone ever intended. The auto workers in their contracts had no deductibles, no copays. So there was no reason for them to avoid going to the doctor to consume health care wisely. There was no cost or economic incentive. Hardly anyone else in America had that kind of a plan, not even members of Congress, by the way.
Now, as things got tough, they would get together and they would talk about correcting the situation. How many of the adjustments were positive?
Well, there were from time to time there were sort of these reform and rebirth movements in Detroit, such as in the mid 1980s. The Chrysler minivan launched in 1984 was a spectacular success. The Ford Taurus launched in a couple years later was another great success in styling. It changed automotive styling. And then beyond that, you know, the SUV boom in the 90s was something the Japanese missed entirely. They just couldn't imagine that Americans would buy off-road vehicles and never take them off-road. It's hard to believe, but in the year 1999, just over 10 years ago, Ford and General Motors earned a combined $13.2 billion. That's the record profits.
But did they put all their eggs in one basket?
Well, they did. They became, if you will, a one-legged stool, Leonard. I mean, all the profits were based on SUVs, and this gusher of SUV profits prevented them from taking the real corrective steps about getting rid of the jobs bank, reforming the health care and pension plans, changing their whole labor management relations and improving product innovation. Instead, GM, for example, in the early years of the last decade, the early years of this century, made a major bet on subprime home mortgages to offset. They wanted a second leg of the stool. It wasn't small cars. It was subprime mortgages.
But they did think in terms of small cars. They came up with the Saturn as the American answer to the Japanese cars, which in an earlier fuel crisis, an earlier oil crisis, suddenly were selling very well. The Saturn was supposed to be the American Honda. What happened?
It's a sad story, and it's one of the chapters, Chapter 8 in Crash Course, is devoted to that. But basically, Saturn was not only a small car, but it was also built with a very innovative labor management agreement, a new factory down in Spring Hill, Tennessee, near Nashville, without all the work rules, the dozens of job classifications that assigned work by different job classifications was absent from the Saturn contract. Workers' pay was tied to quality and productivity and profitability. In other words, the success of the company.
And did the UAW go along with that?
Well, for a while it did, but then a new generation of UAW militant leadership took over in the mid-90s. And at the same time, GM was starting to realize that it couldn't really support eight brands. It didn't have the courage, if you will, to kill the brands. So it just starved Saturn for new products. Saturn didn't get a single new product for almost a decade. So you had the union and the company, for separate reasons, collaborating to kill Saturn.
Was Pontiac doing that much better?
Not really. No. Pontiac has been on a decline for, 10, 15 years. But GM was afraid Saturn would undermine Pontiac. It was all this trade-off stuff.
So it was a Pontiac because that was the old line car, and that's the car that they grew up with, where Saturn was the new kid on the block.
Exactly.
And so what's the story with Saturn now? Is anybody making any?
No. Saturn's going to go away. It's being liquidated. The brand is being discontinued. The president's task force basically forced General Motors to trim down from eight brands to four. Saturn's one that's going away.
But there was another problem with Saturn. At least this is what buyers told me. It wasn't as good as the Japanese cars that it was based on, and they couldn't understand why. If the Japanese built really great cars initially by simply imitating what the Americans were doing, why couldn't the Americans build great cars by simply imitating what the Japanese were doing?
There are just too many cultural barriers, to be honest with you. I mean, the whole idea of continuous improvement and really rigorous engineering just wasn't there. There were too many trade-offs in the production process and in the design process. But you're right. Saturn was not as good as the Japanese competition. Now, frankly, for a while, they made up with that by having superior customer service. You were treated like a king in those dealerships. But after a while, when that sort of wore off, the novelty of that wore off, then sales started to slide.
How many brands has General Motors shed now?
It shed half of its brands, four of the eight brands, so Saturn, Saab, Pontiac, and Hummer.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for the Saturn, all the other cars were really made elsewhere initially, weren't they?
Well, Pontiac wasn't. Pontiac was made here, but and actually Hummer was too. Hummer was made here, but Saabs, you're right, were a Swedish brand made in Sweden. GM bought control of Saab about 20 years ago, and frankly, they kept it for two decades, even though it was unprofitable the entire time.
And it doesn't sell well elsewhere?
Well, a little bit. Not much, no. I mean, it's really fallen further and further behind BMW and Audi and Mercedes and the other competing luxury brands.
You wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal in which you said that Rick Ragnar had to go, but his track record, should we look at it for a moment?
Sure.
GM's stock price declined from more than $70 a share to under $3 a share. In 2005, when car sales stood at near record levels, the company lost $10.6 billion and the stock plunged nearly 75% from 2000. GM also suffered a steady slide in the U.S. market share from 28% to 22% during his tenure. In 2001, he negotiated the European alliance with Fiat. Then GM had to pay $2 billion to buy its way out of that deal. And yet he was kept in office for how long?
Eight years.
Is that because the board liked him?
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's remarkable. You were kind enough to mention my Pulitzer Prize back in 1993. And in that year, the General Motors Board of Directors, actually the prior year in 92, replaced management. They basically said, you know, we're going to get the CEO out of here. We're going to bring in a new generation of younger, more progressive leaders, including, by the way, Rick Wagner, who was made chief financial officer at age 39. This board, the more recent General Motors board, in contrast, just sort of sat by and wrung its hands but did little else. In fact, even some company executives called them the board of bystanders.
You tell the story of Gene Young and Fred Young, two Chrysler employees.
Yeah, it's Gene and Fred are wonderful, wonderful people. Father and son team, both worked at Chrysler's Belvedere, Illinois factory. Fred, the father, started in 1965 when the factory opened. Gene started in 1999, took a buyout last year. Gene actually told me that during his decade working for Chrysler, he only built cars half the time, but he was collecting basically full pay for being in the jobs bank the other half the time. Sort of symptomatic of the whole issue.
And did they think this was okay, or did they realize that this ultimately was going to hurt the company that was paying them?
Well, no, they're smart guys. They understood that this was a problem, but who's going to walk away from a gravy train like that, Leonard, honestly? I mean, it takes a lot of courage to walk away from that voluntarily.
So how have they coped with the tumultuous events of the past year?
Well, Fred, they're in different positions, of course, because Fred is in his early 70s at retirement age, and Fred's doing fine. He was worried that he would lose his pension in the bankruptcy, but the government kept the pensions for GM and Chrysler people intact. Gene took a buyout, and, you know, he's driving a school bus now, and he's thinking about starting a small business, installing small commercial and home antennas and that sort of thing. But he's taken a salary hit. There's no doubt about it. And it'll be an adjustment for him.
My guest is Paul Ingrassia. His book, Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many people said that when GM and Chrysler declared bankruptcy, it was going to be a real problem for them because people didn't want to buy cars from a bankrupt company. Has it turned out that way?
Well, in part. But, I mean, it wasn't that people sort of fled wholesale because the company was bankrupt. People were angry, and understandably so, because they took government money. In other words, they had poor management, and we had to spend tens of billions of dollars to bail them out. But the truth is, you know, Rick Wagner kept saying bankruptcy is not an option. It was the only option. The company's debt levels, the company's union contracts, the company's brand structure was all unsustainable. They had to get a clean, fresh start.
Well, hasn't General Motors emerged from bankruptcy?
Yes, they have. GM and Chrysler emerged from bankruptcy in just
over
a month.
How did they do it so quickly?
With the help of the Obama administration.
Oh, you mean they give them a lot of money and suddenly they're not bankrupt anymore?
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much it, yeah.
Do you have any predictions as to whether we're going to have a big three in 10 years?
Well, we're not going to have a big three this year, frankly. We're not going to have a big three anymore. We're going to have a medium six. That's the structure of the industry in Europe. And basically, instead of the old days when GM had more than half the market and everybody else divided the rest, you're going to have about six companies, GM, Ford, Toyota, Nissan, Honda, maybe Chrysler, Fiat, or, I really don't know, will have between 8 and 20% of the U.S. market. So there'll be much more competition, much more companies going in different directions on technology, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, all electric cars. There won't be one industry leader anymore.
Many of those companies, even the foreign companies, make cars in the United States.
Absolutely.
But they don't make them in Detroit anymore.
No, they don't. And frankly, they don't make them in union factories either. I mean, the UAW tried very hard to organize Honda and Nissan over the past 20 years or so, and it failed at every attempt. The workers just voted no. And, you know, those factories don't have this contentious labor relations situation. They don't have the myriad work rules that sort of prevent a guy from fixing a machine, even though he knows how to do it because it's not his job classification. So they operate much more efficiently.
You told me earlier that although you don't live in Detroit, you're about to go there next week.
Tomorrow.
What is Detroit like these days? Is it in depression mode, similar to what we saw during the 30s, as some people have suggested?
Yeah, it's pretty close to that. I mean, obviously the government safety net is much better than it was in the 30s, but it's a very sad place in a lot of ways because it's like the big source of income for the whole area has been not disappeared but downsized, and there's a lot of people, frankly, who have lost their jobs at the car companies who would love to move and relocate elsewhere and get another job, but they can't find a job or sell their house if they did find a job elsewhere because housing prices are so depressed.
The city government has gone through a series of crises on its own.
Yes.
But what about the state government? Is Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm doing a good job, do you think?
Well, that's up for the voters of Michigan to decide, I guess, but I don't think so. I don't think she's really done anything positive to create jobs in that economy. And it's sad because, when I was growing up as a teenager in the 1960s, I lived in suburban Chicago. Michigan was the place where the rich people lived. They had the best companies. They had the best unions. They had the most prominent national politicians and that sort of thing. We used to envy Michigan.
Are we doing better, at least, in building better cars?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the competition.
Because that was part of the problem, wasn't it? There was the perception that if you wanted a car that was going to have a good record, you had to buy a Japanese car, a Honda, a Toyota.
Yeah, exactly. And the big three, to their credit, have really improved their quality as a result of this new competition. Now, by the way, Ford is the best example of that by far. In fact, Consumer Reports now rates Ford's quality equal to Honda and Toyota, which is remarkable.
Now, Andrew Leonard at Salon.com reports that General Motors might not even need a huge recovery in the American market to post big numbers next year because they're doing so well in China and India.
Well, especially in China, they are. And don't forget, they've also taken a lot out of their cost structure here. President Obama's automotive task force reduced GM's debt level from about $55 billion to $17 billion. Now, a lot of investors took a bath with that, obviously, but that's what happens in a bankruptcy. So GM has a very lean capital structure, a much leaner corporate structure. So if car sales rebound to the 11, 11.5 million vehicle a year level, up from about 10 million now, GM should be able to do pretty well.
Well, in November, GM sold 150,676 vehicles in the U.S., and they sold 177,339 vehicles in China. They're selling more cars in China than they are in the United States.
Well, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but they're very close, let's put it that way.
And then GM sold 70,000 vehicles in India in 2009, expected to sell 100,000 in 2010, and they've just debuted a nifty new high-mileage small car, the Chevrolet Beat.
It's not surprising that China and India are the leading growth markets. I mean, you have countries that where people have not had personal transportation, but they also are now gaining emerging wealth, if you will. One of the first things that people want is personal transportation. It's their freedom.
So where do you see the future? In the past, when we've been through these roller coaster cycles, we wanted fuel-efficient cars, and then we wanted big SUV-type cars, and then we wanted fuel-efficient cars. Are we just going to keep on doing that, or have we learned our lessons?
No. Look, the only thing that has pushed Americans from bigger cars to smaller cars over the years has been high gas prices. Happened in 1973 with the Arab oil embargo, 1979 with the Iranian oil crisis, and then in 2008 with oil prices going to $4 a gallon. If Congress was really serious about this, as opposed to doing political posturing, they would stop the corporate average fuel economy laws and start raising gas prices. Now, they probably ought to offset that with an income tax cut so you're not, you know, you're taxing consumption and not production. But if you had $4 or $5 a gallon gasoline in this country,
as they do in Europe,
you would have small cars. Market forces would work.
And you want small cars. Many Americans say they're afraid of small cars because if you're on the road next to an SUV, you're not very safe.
Well, the truth is, though, that if we had $4, $5, $6 a gallon gasoline, you'd have a lot more small cars, and there'd be fewer SUVs. I'm not against SUVs either. They're very utilitarian vehicles, but they can be a lot more downsized and a lot more efficient than these minibuses going around
the roads. Why are you going to Detroit tomorrow?
Well, the auto show, the press days of the auto show are beginning Monday, and I'm going to see some old friends the day before.
Hmm. Meanwhile, we have this book to talk about here, Paul Ingrassia's Crash Course, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster, is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Leonard. A pleasure.